Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. It is April 5th, 2018, and I'm your host, James Jones. This is episode 566. I'm joined today by Mr. Guillaume Vaillette.
I have returned.
You have. We all have. Mr. Greg Leahy.
Oh, yeah, everyone.
And our survivor, our designated survivor even, Mr. John Lindemann.
My own personal disaster, day of crisis.
That's true. You know what? You got to be Steve, except you didn't fall in a volcano.
This is true. Thankfully.
Presumably you weren't wearing a jumpsuit either.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, how widespread does news of stuff like this trickle out? Because, you know, you're actually in the area, you know, you always, you know,
so
you hear about
if,
it. It's
if
the biggest
answer,
thing ever.
If
but.
The answer is not as far as you would, as we apparently think, John experienced an earthquake today.
I did. I've experienced, you know, because I live, you know, in Southern California, so you experience earthquakes, but this was the first time where I actually...
A bigger one.
Yeah, it was a bigger one. This one was a 5.3, and it was the first one where I was in a place where it was very obvious that an earthquake was going on in real time. And it's a very, very weird experience. Like, I mean, I've lived out here for about 4 years now. And, you know, most of the time it's like you hear about earthquakes and only retroactively realize that what you felt at that point was an earthquake. I mean, I've had it where I've been at work and I thought somebody was like moving my chair or something without me knowing about it. And then I was like, oh, wait a minute. I think that was just an earthquake. So you get a lot of that. You get a lot of like the lower magnitude, like 2 point whatever earthquakes that really don't register. Or, you know, if you're asleep or they happen overnight, you won't wake up. Like, nothing falls off the walls. There's no drama. There's nothing dumb like that. But this was one where a friend and I were at lunch. This happened at 12:29 p.m. We're at lunch.
Exact times are important on Radio Free Nintendo.
They are. Because we're all
drive
about,
towards the most
about
important
facts.
Facts.
We're all journalists
the
here.
The story's already going in more detail than I expected, but okay, continue.
Yeah, well, it was just weird because we were upstairs at a restaurant that we frequent. And all of a sudden the whole place started shaking. I thought something
restaurant.
Yeah. With, you know, I thought that, you know, cause it had like a wooden floor and it was just incredibly weird because at first I was like, oh, somebody's moving something heavy across a wooden floor because I could tell the floor was moving underneath me. And then it just kept going and going. And we're like, wait a minute, this is an earthquake. And so we're sitting there looking at each other like, this is an earthquake. And it just kept going. And then, you know, we felt the strong tremor stop and then it just kind of kept trailing off. And then we're like, okay, I guess the earthquake's over. And it was just really weird. Like, it was just, you're acutely aware that the building you're in is moving underneath you, and it's not something that is stable. It's a really, really weird feeling. It's hard to describe. But you're just like, wait a minute, I am actually in midair here. And this thing that's underneath me that's propping me up could potentially go sideways either way, and there's nothing I can do to stop it. So it's very strange.
But you didn't have to, and you made it.
I did.
You made it through the other side. You didn't need to be rescued by Ray in his muscle shirt.
I feel like I'm gonna go. I feel like I could fight a bear right now. I don't know about you guys.
I you know what? Go try it.
I'm gonna report. I might give it a shot.
All this just reminds me of the best YouTube comment I've seen on an episode so far since they started getting posted, which is simply, "Who is Steve Hewitt?"
What's scary is I don't know if that was a joke or if it was somebody very confused that we keep mentioning some guy named Steve who must have been on the show in the past.
Yeah,
that we tragically lost.
Yeah,
that
we tragically
that we
lost
were dangling him over a volcano.
Yeah,
for
I mean, you know, I mean,
I'm not gonna say who let him go, but is his name starts with Johnny and ends with Mets. But that's okay, you know. Some of us didn't appreciate Steve Hewitt the way others did.
Yep. I mean, who is Steve Hewitt? I mean, some say he's a hero.
Some say he's in all of us.
Yep. Some say he's an inspiration, but, you know.
Some say he died in a volcano, but who knows?
Some say he came back.
Steve Hewitt the man died in a volcano. Steve Hewitt the legend was born.
I thought he just came back in a mechanical suit and was like a tyrant.
We don't talk about Robo Steve Hewitt yet.
Yeah, so there you go. I survived. Here I am. To podcast right, with all you
James mocked your attention to detail, saying exactly the place and time you were at in whatever. But I think it's important for future time travelers to know exactly where you were so they can go and save you.
Yep.
I think you're smart.
And or push him off the building.
Well, clearly that didn't happen, so...
Because mm-hmm. they haven't time traveled. We haven't created the time paradox yet. Mm. Now
it's more of a 12 Monkeys kind of situation where they're kind of studying our recordings. And
can't change history. Yeah, they can travel in time, but they know they can't actually change history.
Right.
So it's just going to help them in their time.
Exactly.
To know that.
Once somebody goes back in time and rescues John from the danger that wasn't, what will happen instead is that they'll have created a parallel fork in time, at which point there'll be a second reality in which John was saved from the no danger, and the one where he was not saved from the no danger, and in which case he continues to exist in both of them, and this become the most boring parallel realities to exist.
At what point does Biff own a casino?
All of them.
Oh, okay.
All of them.
Because that's the most important thing. I mean, if Biff owns a casino, the game's up. We might as well just forget it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess...
Biff's actual first name Sheldon? Because the at one is the one we live in right now.
I guess I should start looking for a sports almanac, right?
Do they even still make those?
Yeah. I think they do.
The least believable part of Back to the Future is they still publish book sports on
it. It wasn't just like a USB stick with more statistics on it.
BaseballReference.com is great. Anyway, let's just roll into new business from there. John, of course, has the freshest new business in that he's still alive. So that's good to know. I have to put a note here in my notes that say when I say John talked about fear, I don't mean the video game. Greg,
yes,
you actually have another new release.
Yeah, my little bit of time traveling was back to 1984, not 1985, Back to the Future.
We're tying it all together.
Yeah, but so it's Arcade Punch Out. You know, I've talked about this. I've been looking forward to it, playing it. You know, it's pretty notable thing. You know, the first time this has been purchasable. This game and Punch Out, I've talked about before. Mike Tyson's Punch Out on NES was kind of a seminal game for me because that was the kind of the main thing when we got our NES back in the Christmas of 1987, and I was 3.5. It's basically the first video game I can remember playing, so you know, it's got a big place in the sort of my personal Nintendo history, and then to kind of go back and see, you know, where the series kind of got started and how it's different from the NES game and whatnot is something, you know, I've been looking forward to with the announcement of the arcade classics, you know, extending into at least some of Nintendo's arcade games. And, as I've read up, you know, on it over the years, so there wasn't many surprises to be had or anything, but it's been fun playing it again. If you've played Super Punch-Out for the Super Nintendo, there is a Super Punch-Out arcade game as well, which was kind of the sort of sequel-ish to this particular arcade game. But Super Punch-Out on SNES is very much more like the arcade game than Mike Tyson's Punch-Out was on NES in terms of the format, like having one round rather than having it split into three. And the way the kind of you're building up a super kind of knockout punch works, as opposed to the way you kind of got star punches and had stamina in the NES game. So, you know, so if you've played Super Punch Out on Super NES, you've got a pretty good idea of how this arcade game works. It's pretty similar, although where Super Punch Out on Super Nintendo kind of showed. Yeah, was, I guess, the feeling, I mean, that was, 10 years after this arcade game? It's kind of, you know, funny for them to then say, okay, I guess we can kind of do it more like the arcade game now. The technology's kind of caught up to some extent, which is a funny thing to think about, you know, back then. But, you know, 10 years being such a long time in the development of the video games, you know, kind of market and industry. But there's a couple of funny things I noticed. Like, it's quite impressive, I think, for something from 1984. Although, obviously, I was it wasn't going to be going around arcades to know, you know, how it would have stood up against its contemporaries. So it was too young for that. But, you know, like, it's funny because you've got sprite scaling when the signature sort of part of the Punch-Out games, the big cartoony expressive kind of opponent boxer sprites, when they move, you know, in from their corner and all that, it just scales smoothly. You know, using very much the kind of scaling effect that you'd see on Super Nintendo some years later, but not in Super Punch-Out, funnily enough. On Super Nintendo, that was like the one game where they could have used sprite scaling and didn't, because I mean, it was especially early on, and you get the feeling if Super Punch-Out had been an earlier game in the SNES library, it probably would have had this. But because it came a few years later, I guess the allure of like, oh look, you know, look, we're like the Super Tennis intro where it's just a tennis ball going in and out of the screen, you know. I mean, it was ActRaiser doing the map thing and all that, you know, it Castlevania 4's levels, like everything had to have some sort of scaling rotation gag within the first like year or so. I guess the novelty had worn off. So funnily enough, they didn't replicate that when they got to Super Punch-Out on SNES. But they did make use of the SNES's sort of ability to do transparencies for your player, which definitely is a lot nicer than the wireframe thing that you've got going on in this arcade game, which, you know, people may have seen, you know, like Little Mac's alternate costume in Super Smash Brothers referencing that. You know, it, obviously it's not that attractive. I guess it works. It conveys the point that it's trying to. But yeah, the transparencies in Super Punch-Out is a lot nicer. But you know, for something of this vintage, it definitely, you know, kind of must have been impressive back in the day. And the gameplay is, if anything, kind of even more sort of twitchy and actiony than Super Punch-Out on SNES, because, you know, if you think of Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, it's very kind of, it's more puzzly almost, you know, it's much more about working out exactly what the routine is, you know, having these very clearly sort of defined windows for attacking, you know, earning star punches and then knocking them out, you know, and this... clearly, there's some of that here. That's kind of where it came from. But because it was an arcade game, it's all designed to be over much more quickly. It's more designed to kind of, you know, for people, you know, just to take people's coins, basically. So, you know, you kind of... The system of building up the bar for getting super punches, it lends itself a lot more to being kind of a matter of momentum almost, you know, of getting on the roll. You know, every time a punch of yours kind of lands, you're building it up. If it gets blocked or you get hit, it falls back down. And whereas in Super Punch-Out, you kind of built up to the point where you could like repeatedly hit them if you built up that bar. With this, it's just, you know, a right hook or an uppercut that, you know, is going to hit really hard. It's not quite that advantageous. But the fact is, you know, if you could just get on a little roll of, okay, I block or dodge their punches, and then, you know, I can start really hitting them with my super punches, which, you know, as long as you don't lose anything off that bar, you can do it, you know, repeatedly, it's, you know, a fight can be over really quickly. On the other hand, just a few times getting hit or whatever, and you kind of lose the rhythm of it, and you're not building up that super, you could get knocked out really quickly. So, you know, the arcade, you know, origin of it is very apparent in that, and how the converse, you could see how for NES, how much they thought about, okay, you know, it's a home game, it's not going to be as impressive to look at, we need to think about kind of extending the experience and making it more involved and, you know, something that's going to benefit more from repeated play and all this kind of stuff. I mean, you've still got a lot of the fundamentals of Punch-Out here, of course, and I mean, every character's got it. There's only like universal tell in this rather than, I don't know, like more characters specific stuff that you'd see on NES where, you know, somebody's eyebrow going up at a particular point, or the little jewel on Great Tiger's headdress lighting up or whatever. In this case, everybody's eyes go yellow when they're going to attack you, which is kind of slightly disturbing, but, you know, it's very clear, I guess. You know, it's not something you're going to have to work to spot or anything, and it doesn't change so much. So again, kind of more suitable for arcade play. And in general, I haven't been able to put that much time in with it yet. I've got to the fourth of the six fighters, which is kind of interesting because in many ways, like the one I'm on now, Kid Quick, he's like one of the least likely to knock me out. He's not really that deadly. Like when you compare him with a Bull, who could do that charge that knocks you out straight away. That's, you know, something that carried over to his subsequent incarnations in other Punch-Out games. Isn't that deadly, but it's harder to knock him out, and you have to. You can't, like, win on points in this. So you have got to get him down a number of times, or, you know, I don't know whether if you can use a knockout punch at the right time, maybe you can just kill him in one knockout, but I haven't been able to do it yet. So, he hasn't got a kind of a big, like, routine, like a Bull, or even Piston Hurricane, who's got that kind of flurry of high-low punches, and there's another two after that, I think, culminating in Sandman, who's the last boss of the Punch-Out for Wii, is kind of a reference to that, I believe. So yeah, I'm really glad it's here. I've had quite a bit of fun playing it. I guess the other thing to note is the vertical orientation stuff. Because it was two screens in the arcade, apparently because Nintendo had a surplus of arcade monitors and decided this was the best way to get rid of them.
As good a reason as any.
You just move a bunch of, like, you know, kind of HUD stuff onto a second screen and put some character portraits on there. Like, your kind of contender character portrait is, you know, obviously there was no reason for him to be Little Mac at this point, because, you know, they could do the see-through, the wireframe thing, rather than him being tiny, like on NES. He does look a bit Sylvester Stallone-ish if you gave him, like, dark green scarecrow hair. But that was basically the template for a boxer in the mid-80s, wasn't it? A man who had never boxed. So, yeah, that's just the 80s for you. They were pretty silly. But,
what? Got... No.
I have first-hand experience. And I guess the biggest thing is they put the health of you and your opponent on that other screen. And so if you are playing on the TV, or you're playing horizontally, you know, portable mode kind of thing, with the Switch, and you're going to have the screens next to each other, so you're avoiding them being really tiny if you're actually putting them, you know, in the it would be if you put them vertically. Then the kind of the health is getting split off from, you know, what you're focusing on, which is, it's not a huge thing, but there's the occasional sort of instance where you might really want to think about, okay, you know, he's a couple of punches away from going down, so I might just try and fit in, you know, one or two extra blows here. Conversely, like, okay, I'm not going to get him down in this flurry of punches, so I may as well kind of defend and then wait for another opportunity to attack, because he's not going down that soon anyway. So just the fact that it's like next to the display rather than actually part of it in that horizontal configuration is not ideal. Of course, you can, you know, do the Tarte mode thing and put it in a vertical display, which is, you know, kind of the nicest way to do it, because then the health just stacks on top of the primary play area. But of course, you know, I mean, I've got a hoary play stand, I can do it that way. It's not the most convenient thing in the world. We're still waiting for the grip type thing that a bunch of people have been asking for. I know Jeremy Parrish has shown off something like he's a prototype that they're making with Fangamer or something. It's, you know, somebody is moving towards making one of these things that I think would be quite useful. The Pinball Arcade guys just added vertical mode to their game. You know, which is really cool. I think it benefit pinball a hell of a lot. And it's just, you know, the thing that holds it back for me is it's just but not as convenient to, you know, take the Joy-Con off and have to then put the Switch in a stand rather than kind of take the Joy-Con off and just put them right next to it in a grip and have that comfort for extended play. So I'm kind of hesitant to go too much into it or put too much time into any of those games when I kind of feel like the optimal play experience is still waiting for me somewhere down the road. I'm really glad that it is in there because, like I said, it is definitely, even now, just taking the Joy-Con off and putting it in the Hori stand, that's the best way to play it. Great thing to have it. Been a fair bit of fun so far. And I'll probably put in some more hours one day when we get the grip.
There you go. My favorite part about arcade Super Punch-Out, because I played it a couple times, my favorite part is just random piece of knowledge I have about the game, is that it was like weirdly, not pirated, like bootlegged in Europe on a bunch of like the Commodore and stuff and the Spectrum. And they actually, it's a licensed bootleg. They actually have a real boxer's name attached to it, even though they just straight up copied the boxer.
Yeah, it's a
game.
Weird combination of licensing, but also stealing.
Yes, Frank Bruno's Boxing, I believe, is the name of the game.
But my favorite, so crazy.
My favorite part about it is they created a couple other characters that are also horrible stereotypes, and I had to look these up because I wanted to make sure I was right. They are Tribal Trouble, which is bad right away. Already we're in a bad place. Raviolo Mafioso.
Yeah, I mean, was it Pizza Pasta? Is this
Pizza Pasta is the one here, which
Nintendo,
is amazing.
Like actual Nintendo equivalent.
Pizza Pasta is amazing, but the my absolute favorite, and I didn't have to look this one up. I was just like, I can't be remembering this right, but I sure was. Frenchie France.
Wow.
They
must have had a lot of lot of group thinking that one. Okay, guys, let's sit down. We got to think of a name here.
It makes Glass Joe look like this incredible achievement of subtlety, doesn't it?
Exactly. The nuance of Glass Joe.
Well, how are we going to make sure people know he's French? What if we call him Frenchie? Okay, what is his last name going to be? France? Done.
I'm thinking three names. I'm from France. How do you like that? From being the middle name.
F. Just, yeah, it's implied.
I'm F France. Well. You know, we're gonna let him use his full name. Oh, good Lord. Guillaume, have you also been dealing with burly men?
Wow, what a transition. Yes, I have.
He prefers them nubile, James. We all know that.
Oh, I think you're about to be surprised, John.
Oh, yeah, God.
No, I do like my men burly and at sea. So I've been assigned the review for Burly Men at Sea. Yes,
just
it's
say
an
it, John.
Actual
just
name.
Just say the burly seaman joke. Just get it over with.
I'm not going to say it. I didn't even go there. I didn't even...
I could hear you dying.
No, I don't even know what's going on right now. Please continue, Guillaume.
So there's a game called Burly Men at Sea. It came out, I'm pretty sure, on PC, but on tablets and stuff a while ago. And it's a game that got some awards at IGF. What is IGF? Independent Games Forum? Foundation?
Festival? I think it's Independent Festival? Games Festival, I think, yeah.
All right,
it's Festival.
It got an honorable mention for excellence in narrative at IGF 2017. And so it's coming out on Switch next week, and I picked it up for the review, and I'm not sure what's going on, to be honest, either, because it seems to be, and this is kind of something that I wish perhaps more narrative games would do, seems to be about finding different kind of patterns or different stories. I'm not putting that well at all. Sorry.
So is there a game you would compare it to that might help us understand what you mean?
It's very much kind of a short little story. It's a game that you can play through in like maybe, you know, 30 minutes, 40 minutes. And basically you choose your path and the choices that you make will affect the story and will change the outcome more or less. Without getting into too much details, because the entire point is going through the story, so I can't really, I don't know, I don't really want to spoil anything, but
sure.
You know, they find a way to make it so that the story kind of repeats, and so you can end up choosing differently your next time through, but the characters that you talked to before remember you. And I'm not sure if that means that no two play, like, I haven't tried to make the exact same choices as a previous run before. So I don't know if the story would change if I did that, but you can definitely kind of make different choices. And kind of get different outcome. The thing is though, like I haven't played it enough so far to really have a good idea of what it is exactly that I can affect in the story. The game basically opens with the three like fishermen, bearded and burly and all that, finding a map in a bottle. And so the map is kind of incomplete, and it just promises adventure. And so Brave Beard, Steady Beard, and Hasty Beard all decide that they want to go on an adventure. So they're going to go and follow the map. And when you do, once you complete the run through the story, it kind of shows you what on the map, where you went, basically. Like, basically just shows you icons of the different decisions that you took. And those icons kind of get recorded, and you can kind of, you know, to show you where you've been already. And the next playthrough, like, if you make different choices, you're going to have different icons.
Can you see your previous, for lack of a better word, footsteps?
Not really. Like, oh, yeah, okay. you kind of have to remember what decisions you took before, but there are not so many decisions that you might completely forget.
Gotcha.
what you've done before. But the big trouble for me right now is that I'm not sure if this is kind of a roguelike narrative game where eventually you might unlock kind of a different decision path. Or if I'm really not seeing that first step that I can, like, that first decision that I can take. Because every time that I played, I got eaten up by a giant whale. All my stories started like that. And I'm sure there's a way to avoid it, because the whale's represented by an icon on all my previous playthroughs. And so I think that if that was an unchanging story element, it would just not show up, because it's not something I can affect. So I need to figure out, like, perhaps there's some way for me to play through the game in a certain way that it will have kind of it will permanently change what happens with the whale. Anyway, this is kind of way too abstract, more abstract than I wanted it to be. But basically, you know, you can tell by the title, of course, like it's very much kind of a, you know, it's irreverent. It's very cute. It's well written. Like, there's, you know, all sorts of fun words that they use in this game, like women folk or whatever that you don't usually hear, you know, like it's got this kind of tales, like, you know, fairy tale kind of storytelling to it. Like the game looks good. Like, I mean, like, it's very minimalist looking. It's nice to look at. It's well written. I do think that eventually I would like to be able to skip certain story scenes or certain, because every time that you play through the game, you're always going to end up back on the island, and you're going to have to walk back to, like, the first house that you went in, and you have to make that trek every time, and it takes you a certain amount of time every time. And I kind of wish at this point that there was some way to fast forward through bits that I've seen before and that the game knows that I've seen before. Another issue is that this is a game that was on an iPad, and so it's made for touchscreens, and I still haven't played it on the touchscreen on the Switch. I've got no reason to think that that wouldn't work out. The trouble is, when I've been playing it on television, by default, the game uses motion controls, doesn't explain it, and just really makes me wish that there was still manuals for video games at all, because it could really use it. Like, the game seems to think that these motion controls are very intuitive, and they're really not. I ended up disabling the motion controls, ended up using the stick to move the cursor around, and that ended up just working out much better for me. I was excited to you know, use the pointer, because I actually like that feature in Wii games, but here it didn't really work out. And the kind of the controller, normal controller controls actually make a lot of sense and are really good. You know, you basically use the left shoulder button to move left and the right shoulder button to move right. And, you know, like the stick controls the cursor, and then you click on things, that it all works exactly as you want it to. So I'm glad that they kind of they tried to include pointer controls, but maybe I need to get used to them. I don't know. What else is there to say about this game?
Are you enjoying it?
I think so, but it does get a little bit, you know, samey after a while. Like, especially because every time that I played the game, the beginning was the same, the ending was the same. I can play it two times, like maybe twice an evening, and then I'm like, you know, that's enough about that. But when I'm playing it, like, it's enjoyable enough. It's just, I'm still trying to figure out the game. But yeah, like in theory, on paper, the game is kind of exactly what I'd want a narrative video game experience to be. Like, you actually have an effect on how the story unfolds, and it's well written, and it keeps you engaged. But you know, maybe there are a few things I would do differently. I'm hoping that I'm going to have a more complete and fuller and maybe more better thought out review out there by the time that the podcast comes out. So you can go check that out on Nintendo World Report. But yeah, like, it's an interesting experiment. Quickly, I just wanted to touch on, there's this game that came out, that's coming out soon on Switch, and I almost took on the review for it, but then I saw that there was a demo, and I was like, well, I'll try the demo first before kind of committing to something that might not be so good. The game is called Deep Ones, and it's a love letter to ZX Spectrum games. So that's, kind of interesting. I know we've got lots of ZX Spectrum fans on this podcast, so
you already got me hooked.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, it's got that kind of look of, you know, like, black background.
We have five colors to use.
Five. Well, the game does cheat with that, but it does use that color palette of, you know, very bright primary, you know, kind of...
Fuck you. If Horus didn't need 10 colors, you don't need 10 colors.
Mm-hmm. The game cheats. But, you know, like, the characters, everything in the game is kind of, you know, just an outline on a white, on a black background. You know, very kind of flashy primary colors, like fluorescent.
Yeah.
But it does have kind of nice little kind of, particle effects or whatever, like when you're shooting a harpoon and it hits a rock, like it just illuminates the area. So, you know, like it's kind of an HD-fied, definitely, ZX Spectrum game, but while still using characters and art that is very pixelated. So I was interested, but after playing the demo, and so it's unfortunate because I don't have a ton of experience with ZX Spectrum games, but I have played, like, emulations of Manic Miner or whatever, like Jet Set Willy or, you know, whatever it is. And I don't remember there being so much input lag. This game has a ton of input lag, or at least the demo does, and it kind of messes up. Yeah, it messes up your jumping, it messes up your shooting. It just feels very unfair. So if anyone there is like out there is like me and was kind of intrigued by the look of the game, just give the demo a shot first, because it did not make that good of an impression, especially since, like, for whatever reason, The game only uses two face buttons. It uses the Y face button and the A. So Y to shoot, A to jump. And it's like, what are you doing? How does that make sense? Why did you pick the two buttons, like two buttons that are not next to each other?
Yeah, I guess they really wanted to avoid sympathetic presses.
I suppose so. Or they want you to emulate the, I don't know, playing on a ZX Spectrum keyboard, and they want you to use like your two, like your Findex and middle fingers to press to rest on Y and A. I don't know, but whatever their idea was, it was not a good one. So I don't know. I'm not sure if the demo is completely representative of the full game, because it looked very much like kind of a linear obstacle course, and that ended with a background that said, thank you for playing the demo, and then it kind of faded out. And I kind of wonder if it was a level made specifically for this demo. Just looking at the Steam page gave me the impression it was perhaps more of a Metroidvania kind of style of progression, but I don't know. That impression might be wrong. But it looks like you upgrade your character, you get a lot of power-ups and movement upgrades, but none of that is in the demo, so it's kind of boring.
Curious that it exists, to be honest. Like, it's a...
Well, it is by a Russian developer, I think.
Okay.
So, you know, like, I mean, like, yeah, in Europe, there is nostalgia for ZX Spectrum games. Or so I hear.
Yeah. I didn't realize they had this. Well, I guess they probably had a Spectrum clone in Russia. It's because it's pretty easy to clone those things. It's weird that we're in this, in like, I thought at this point we'd be moving nostalgia forward, because the people who are becoming the, you know, are coming of age to a point where they would want a nostalgic game are now old, or, well, they're not older. They were born later than, mm-hmm. like, the 8-bit nostalgia thing that's been going for the last decade or so. But apparently we're just getting older. We're going to have, like, Pong clone
retrospectives. Coming out, yeah, I mean, they're coming out with, what, like a new Atari 2600, right?
Well, why not? I mean, I think it makes sense. I mean, it's kind of like... There is underserved retro markets out there.
Yeah, you see, that's the thing, James. Like, the Atari 2600 now, it's like this taboo, like, forbidden fruit.
It's not.
The forbidden fruit of warlords. And E.T. the extraterrestrial.
Oh, that's true and dark.
John's got two major contenders for title so far. Nuance of Glass Joe and the Forbidden Fruit of Warlords. Bloody hell.
I don't know. Sitting on I'm period from period France is in there too.
This is what happens when I have a brush with death. I'm getting all my best material out now.
It's very much sort of like the Sistine Chapel. John's index finger has received divine inspiration for really dumb time.
Yeah, exactly.
For a while there, we were going to call this the danger that wasn't, but now that's just completely off the page at this point.
You got options. That's all we're saying.
I've got 10 already. This is a problem. Okay. I'm looking at it and like, yeah, they did go there. Like, this is the look. I'm kind of surprised by this game. I do wish the demo gave you a little bit more for us to go on, though.
Yeah, and you know, like I said, that they're Russian. I actually don't know. I think that the fact that most of the user reviews on Steam seem to be written in some, you know, in that language, but I really don't know.
Yeah, they might be American. I mean, these days, who's to say, right?
Well, anyway, I'm kind of a...
Despite
being a translator, I'm not really... I can't really tell what's, you know, what characters... what language these characters belong to at a glance.
Multiple languages use Cyrillic, but they describe this as... a ZX Spectrum, BioShock, and HP Lovecraft-inspired game, which that is a number of things you could combine into a sentence, I guess. Yeah, it looks kind of trippy.
Yeah, yeah, that's what kind of drew me to it in the first place. It does have kind of a striking look. It's just unfortunate that it doesn't play well, and I don't think that is an homage to ZX Spectrum games.
No, that's accurate.
No, I mean, anyway, the emulations of the many emulations of Manic Miner that I played, James, did not play like garbage. So
you needed to get a copy of Rare Replay. So I'm gonna end the sentence there.
Yeah, despite Fair now enough. Through Rare Replay actually kind of owning a few Spectrum games, I've never touched one.
Wow. You know what? I'm not even gonna argue with that decision.
No, it's probably been prudent to this point in my life.
Okay, they are Ukrainian, so
okay.
There we go.
We've set the facts straight. They can now be beaten to a bloody pulp in a Punch-Out game. Done.
Oh, yeah, but will they be Drunkensky or Popinski? That's the important question.
No, they're Ukrainian. It'll be some horrible reference to, like, Fallout or something terrible. As offensive as we can make it, that's the way of the 80s. Hmm. All right. Is anything else you want to talk about, Guillaume?
Oh, it's more than enough. I think I've done enough damage here.
It's More Than Enough might actually be the correct title for this episode. So I am still playing Atelier. I thought I finished it. I thought it was free. And because right before the show, the game rolled like a credit sequence and everybody's walking out and there's happy singing music and we're seeing what everybody's life is like after the big danger was killed. And then fucking Chapter 7 flashes up on screen and boys, we still in there. So the hook of this game still works. But the problem is I've been so aggressive about collection and making things that I kind of have run out of things to make. And so I'm just making better versions of things I've already made. And so I've just kind of stopped making things at the moment, which means the hook's not there anymore. And I'm just kind of trudging through the story at this point, which is a bummer. Like, I wish the crafting system gave you infinite options or let you research options on your own time. So you didn't have to wait for the story to drip feed you new stuff you can make. Because you may have all the components to make something, but for whatever story reason, the game's just not going to let you make it right now. And then suddenly, like, something will happen, and your main character will give her a little animation that she had an idea for a new thing to make, and then the text at the top of the screen will just scroll through, like, six things she can make now. And it's like, oh, I guess I'll go do that. But, yeah, it's still going. I'm at about 25-plus hours at this point. Which is not the same as the 300 number that the game is telling me I'm at, but, you know, somewhere in the middle between 25 and 300. What I did want to talk about is the game released two DLC packs. Yeah, it did that, but it's just music. They're free DLC to add more music tracks to this game, which already had more music than I will ever need it to have. Effectively doubling the file size of the game, if you download them both. Just featuring music from other games this company made so you can customize your soundtrack options. Yeah, this game, this is going to be a tough review because it's not well made. Like, there's a good idea here and it works sometimes, but man, this game. But I feel pretty confident that I'm going to beat it soon. God. So I can write the review and then move on. But we'll, I don't really have much else to say. I pretty much said what I need to say about the game last time. It just keeps rolling. I want to add one update because I actually listened to the episode and there's one thing I may have not emphasized enough. Performance here is not good. Like, I may have kind of hinted that it wasn't good. I may have said, it's not great, but you can manage. That's true. Game's still playable. You can play the, play it in handheld mode, which performs even worse. But it still performs very poorly, even docked. And I think this game came out on Vita in Japan. So, like, what the fuck, Tecmo Koei?
Well, did it play well in Vita? No,
the last game came out on Vita and the West and was notoriously poor performing.
Oh, well, but, there you go.
But, like, the Switch ain't no Vita. Like, there's a big power gap there.
Yeah.
Like, this game came out on the Switch and PS4 in the West. Came out on the PC and Vita in Japan. Maybe came out on the PC in the West, too. Like, it should perform passably because it looks cheap and low detail and, like, not very intensive. So this game's got problems, and its optimization is chief among them. But that does lead to everybody having the same animation as they run. I mean, everyone has one animation for walking around regardless of the speed, and I just saw a non-player character who is a story character run for the first time, and I just started laughing uncontrollably because it's so bad. But yeah, that's it. This game's got a boatload of issues and one good hook, which is probably the most frustrating kind of game there is, because if it's bad all the way around, you're just like, I'm not gonna play anymore. It's just a bad game. I'm done. But if the hook's good and everything else is not, that's really frustrating, because you could be doing something else, but you kind of want to keep doing this one thing even though the rest of it sucks. So I think at this point I'm going to stop crafting unless it's like designated crafting time where I've got five or six things built up that I can make for the first time, and then just burn through the story otherwise, because the whole collecting and crafting has just slowed down my progress. All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for new business this week. Any objections?
We're good.
Yeah, all right. I think I'm all right.
You still okay, John?
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm good.
Your heart rate back down? You're not scared?
It's probably a little bit elevated, but I think I'll be all right.
All right. Deep breaths. Mm-hmm. And when we come back, after you do your breathing, we'll have time for listener mail. Stay tuned.
Death is stalking me.
Listener mail. That's what this segment's called. And you can send yours to RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com. And then we might just find time to answer it on this show. Our survivor is going to go ahead and read our first email.
Certainly. Do you see how I just assumed it was me? So, anyways.
Well, it's the same. It's the same order as new business, John.
Well, you know, this Beyonce wrote a song about me, right? So whatever. With the Nintendo paid online service. I mean Halo. That's what I'm talking about.
Identify the letter right.
Dear GX writes, I apologize. It's post-traumatic stress disorder, Greg.
Sure. Have you been drinking?
Dear RFN crew.
No, I need to know.
No.
Did you use the break to drink?
No.
Are you trying to suppress your stress with booze?
I can only be so lucky. All right. GX writes, Dear RFN crew, with the Nintendo Pay Online service still largely ethereal as the company continues to quietly kick the can down the road time after time, it is worth taking stock of what we can expect from a for-pay online service at this point in time. We have a long-standing service such as Xbox Live Gold and PlayStation Plus to draw features and structure from, but also online video streaming services such as Twitch Prime, PlayStation Now, Xbox Game Pass, EA Access, Pokemon Bank, and that weird thing Call of Duty tried to do for 2 years. To put some restrictions on it, let's assume the price will remain $20 a year, and that voice chat will still be through their proprietary app, since those are really the only two firm details that we have. Beyond that, do you believe a paid Nintendo online service needs to be to be considered a modern online service? What do you believe a paid Nintendo online service needs to be and to have to be considered a modern online service? What would you like it to have? And finally, what should we reasonably expect it to have based on past Nintendo online experiences? Thanks, and keep up that thing you do with the mouths and the microphones.
Ugh.
Oh, he knows about that?
Yeah.
So GX is asking two questions. What does it need to have, and what do we expect it to have? So I expect each of you to give me two distinct and completely unrelated on the Venn diagram answers. So we'll start with the what do you think it needs to have, and then we'll get to our depressed, like, what do we expect it to have?
Yeah, I mean, so much of that answer for me is kind of colored by what the other the other services do that just as a matter of course.
But keep in mind, he's also set this expectation that it's $20 a year.
Yeah.
Well, Nintendo did.
Well, yeah. But I mean, Nintendo said a lot of things about their online service.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean,
and so far, well, no, I was going to say none of them have been disproved, none of their claims, but...
But most of their claims have been disproved, because most of them are about when it's going to happen.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, at $20 a year, I don't expect it to have any sort of, you know, game of the month thing like Xbox Live Gold or, you know.
Yeah, I mean, at one point, they kind of intimated that they do that with classic games, you know, like have the classic game of the month that would have online interaction, you know, where it wouldn't be something that was a recent release, you know, for Switch.
Yeah.
But then they've kind of backtracked on that and sort of more maybe, you know, sort of access to more of a library of games. So,
yeah. But what I could see them doing, though, is I could see them doing something like, I could see them doing what they said, but for the free version, only having it locked to like a certain time limit or a couple, you know, like having it restricted, and then you have to pay for the real version of whatever they put out there. So you download some sort of demo of the month kind of thing for subscribers.
This is your Dollar Shave Club for classic NES demos?
Pretty much, yeah.
Oh man, are they going to do podcast ads? Because we could use some.
Yeah.
I'll take your money, Nintendo.
Yeah, I'm for sale. I mean, whatever. I've said that many times.
No, we know. Wow. All right.
I love it. It's just so matter of fact, and then everybody just moves on. It's pretty great.
Even I feel bad about that one. Wow.
It is what it is, man.
What I wonder is, so to put some context here, PS Now, PS Plus and Xbox Gold are both $60 a year, right?
Yes.
So $20 a year is obviously a third of that. So
this is why you listen to
fucking
Radio
math,
Nintendo.
Y'all.
Yeah, we bring the facts.
God, as Buffalo Sports Talk Radio is fond of playing this thing. Analytics.
There you go. My point is, obviously, they can be a little bit less full-featured as a consequence of that, I guess.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's necessarily a great excuse, because to be honest, like, what would we describe as not full-featured? So, voice chat
right now, yeah.
But I would quite like there to be voice chat, not in the... All right, is the phone a disaster that's going to go away? And I vote yes. And here's why. Nintendo has released how many online games since the Switch came out? Let's just run through them. Mario Kart, ARMS, Splatoon 2, what else? I feel like I'm missing one.
Flip Wars?
Meh.
I don't know if that's maybe online even. But...
Maybe I'm not missing one. But of course, Smash is coming out this year.
Mm-hmm.
So
the Pokken.
How
much you want to count that? Obviously, because I mean it's, you know, the Pokemon Company and Namco Bandai and all that. But yeah, I mean.
Yeah, but I mean they themselves have been promoting it under their Nintendo Versus label or whatever the fuck they call that thing. But they haven't put that stupid app into anything except Splatoon 2.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where that app should just be called the Splatoon 2 voice chat app.
Sure.
So they don't seem to have any faith in it either. Now, granted, all the other games came out before Splatoon 2.
Mm-hmm.
But Pokken was after it.
Was it?
Yes. I think so. Yeah.
Okay. Well, then fuck me. I don't know what I'm talking about. It doesn't feel like they're really committed to the app. It feels like they said the app. Some engineers like, well, I guess we could do it through phones.
Yeah.
And then like they suggested it kind of half in jest, and then suddenly it existed.
It really feels like a stopgap.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, that's really what I would like to see. I mean, There is a whole bunch of stuff, you know, like on Xbox Live, you know, on their online services, you know, on the PS online service. It's like, I'll never use that stuff. Like, even something like group chat, I'll never use group chat. Like,
we used group chat the other day, John.
Well, but only because we had to for Sea of Thieves, right? Like,
yeah,
we had to, right? That game
I'll
forces you to do it.
I'll never use that. We're using group chat right now.
But I mean, there's just a lot of stuff. Okay, maybe that's a bad example, but I mean, there's a ton of stuff.
No, I know.
There's a ton of stuff that those online services do that, like, you only use maybe if you can get, like, several people, you know, online with you playing a certain game at a certain time. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's very, yeah. It's stuff that most people don't use. So, I mean, to me, it's just, I really just want them to have, you know, really just competent voice chat that's independent of any particular game. That's really what I want.
I would say competent voice chat and competent online performance.
Yeah.
Because that, I cannot overstate how important that is, because we've been through the ringer with Nintendo's online services in the past.
Yeah, brutal. And, like, Super Smash Brothers just being brutal, you know? Slideshow. Yeah. Super Slideshow Brothers, I mean, just brutal.
Is that something... How do you solve that? How do other fighting games solve
that? So, netcode and hardware.
Yeah, I mean, they made massive progress with the Smash Brothers on 3DS Wii U from Wii, didn't they? I mean, it was a lot better.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's always going to be some degree of my internet is not necessarily fast enough to get this data to you when I want it. All right, you know, but what you do is you code around that. Mm-hmm. You code in such a way that it is able to account for the prospect of lag, and the game isn't hampered as a consequence. And so that the user experience, the lag still happened, but the user experience is such that it's okay. That's obviously not the easiest thing in the world to do. Mm-hmm. But that's not part of the network infrastructure. It's part of the individual games being built to a large degree. I mean, some of that is obviously, but the biggest thing that they need is they need their pipeline and their connectivity and their servers and all that stuff to be not shit. Mm-hmm. And that's not a super high bar. And that's ultimately what the idea of the money is for. Now, I think they need to give you something tangible for that $20.
Yeah, because that's the thing. I mean, I've played an awful lot of Splatoon 2, ARMS, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, Rocket League, you know, going outside of the Nintendo developed stuff, but on Switch, and it's been fine, you know. I mean, maybe not perfect or whatever. I don't subscribe to, you know, and haven't to, you know, PS Plus or Xbox Live or whatever, but, you know, so I haven't got that direct frame of comparison, but it's yeah, palatable to me. Certainly we have made progress over the years. So the fact that we've discussed before we've had this, you know, year plus or whatever by September with pretty, you know, sort of passable online, and we've all got used to it and not paying for it, you know, that it, something has to be offered. You know, and I mean, the way I've tried to, in terms of what I expect to see, the way I've tried to kind of calibrate it is by what we haven't had that seems conspicuous by its absence. Because it's like, you feel like, yes, the online service was originally planned to already be here by now, and it isn't. And there's certain things that would have come along with that. That have been delayed, you know, as a result. And you kind of look at that. First of all, we had the whole thing about using the goal points. Like, they waited to the last possible moment to give you any kind of purpose for those, i.e. when the ones that were first purchased were going to expire.
Right.
So, again, it feels like, yep, that probably would have tied in and will tie into the online service, and just, you know, that can got kicked down the road, as GX puts it. Then I think, you know, you've got to look at the classic games. They do seem kind of conspicuous by their absence at this point, more than a year into the system's life. So, yeah, again, and they've explicitly said, you know, that. So how they're going to leverage them is a bit unclear. And they've kind of you know, gone back and forth a bit on that, but that's got to be part of it. Another thing I think is about saves, I think, is an interesting one because, you know, at the moment, we're not even where we were on, like, 3DS or whatever, you know, like, yeah. In terms of with 3DS, you could take your SD card out and just copy the contents of it, and that was, you know, some kind of a backup against something going wrong.
Right.
And losing your obviously you can take the micro SD out, but it's not going to do you any good in that sense. You know, if you have to send your system off, and in the process they wipe everything, you know, yep, you'll be able to get your purchases back, because they're associated with your ID or whatever. But in terms of saves, you know, you couldn't have backed them up before you sent the system. So. Mm-hmm. Cloud save, something like that would certainly be something that people want based on, you know, of their experiences so far. And again, it's just weird to me that there hasn't been any kind of backup option put in yet. Again, it feels like perhaps something that they have a strategy for to maybe tie into the online thing, and then it's just got delayed along with it, you know, kind of just sort of tethered to it. So
yeah, I mean,
those are some of the things, like, I could see.
Cloud saves to me are I'm so used to them now that I forget that Nintendo doesn't have them. Like, that's
but
how
remember,
I mean,
everybody does charge for them though.
Yeah, that's true. Like, true.
Except, and then the Pokemon Steam. Bank, again, we kind of reference
except Steam
that.
Yes.
You know, it's not like completely sort of alien to Nintendo sort of fandom.
Very true.
You know, with the Pokemon Bank example that GX takes. So I do kind of feel like maybe that is something they've got waiting there. That, and, you know, again, originally it probably wouldn't have seemed as severe in terms of this amount of time without being able to back up or, you know, have a resource for your saves, because the online service would have launched like months ago, but it hasn't. So, yeah, that it's just those things that seem conspicuous by their absence, I think, seem like the what I'd be expecting. But yeah, it is always a mystery with Nintendo in this arena, is exactly what's going to happen. I mean, some of the things I'd like to see, I mean, I would really like to see them leverage that, you know, their whole thing is, you know, people playing in the same room. And that's part of the reason why they've been, you know, very kind of lukewarm on online going all the way back. Even though at this point, you know, going back to DS and so it's been, you know, they've been in that arena for a long time. But they've kind of always seemed a little bit half-hearted about it, because it's like, well, it's not our, you know, it's not where our sort of passion lies about creative people, you know, in the same room and all that. But I would say I'd like to see them, okay, you know, if we're about people, you know, playing in the same room, kind of trying to leverage the whole, you know, people with multiple Switches in the same room but going online together kind of thing, like trying to, you know, encourage them to go online. And then if you kind of get them doing that, then it might be more likely that they will then do it when they're not together, you know, when they're not there physically, you know, together, they just meet up online. I feel like that it's a good way to kind of maybe graduate some players kind of to playing online more often if they're not used to that, given Nintendo's previous like ecosystems or something. I'm not exactly sure how you do that and all that kind of thing, but some kind of you know, integration with friends and kind of incentivizing, whether it's an achievement system or, you know, kind of joint achievement, something that just kind of incentivizes them to go online together and achieve things together, whether it be, you know, Splatoon 2 League play, whatever analogous things you could think of for Smash Brothers or whatever.
One of the things that I think they need to have, and I don't know what shape this takes, but I'm kind of thinking about like how Nintendo has done online lately, and it needs to have regular kind of event cadences. And what I mean by that is think about Splatoon and ARMS. Like, both of these games have developed, they've developed these big for lack of a better word, events that happen on a regular basis that essentially promote the game. So for ARMS, what do they call that thing?
The Party Crash, which they didn't have at the start. Like, that was a funny thing, wasn't it, in a way? Even though they were kind of going for a Splatoon, clearly going for it preceded Splatoon 2, but of course, you know, Splatoon on Wii U had already happened, and there was a feeling
inspired.
Like, it was going to follow a similar kind of model in terms of, you know, dripping out new content, new characters, new stages to keep people coming back to the game, to kind of gin up interest and to kind of make the package more robust and more appealing over time. So maybe people who at first were a bit, tepid on it might jump in later. But they didn't have the Splatfest equivalent initially. Eventually they kind of had these party crash events where it's like, you know, specific characters are popularity contests very much, you know, inspired by Splatfest, but they didn't have that from the jump. But with Splatoon 2, of course, you know, the sales are bigger. There's a lot of stages and weapons and gear and all this stuff getting updated all the time, and they've added modes like the Clan Blitz and stuff. So yeah, I mean that's been, you know, very easy. They keep giving people reason to come back to it, so they never go totally cold on it, you know, kind of thing.
I imagine that Nintendo's online service will represent that same kind of thought process, that there's always that they do stuff regularly on a cadence.
And it's a similar sort of proposition in terms of, you know, why do you want to keep people kind of renewing it?
You know?
I mean, it is, if they go cold on using sort of the perks of the service and, you know, it kind of comes up for renewal and it's like, well, to be honest, I haven't really got anything out of this for the past so many months, you don't renew. Whereas, yeah, if you can kind of create these flashpoints for people to re-engage with it periodically, maybe that becomes less likely.
Well, the thing is, that's what their competitors do as well. They do it in the form of free games.
Now, right, but Nintendo is offering, because, you know, there is a page on Nintendo's website that you can go check to see what they've, you know, what they're claiming this.
What their current services. Promises are.
Yeah, and... One of the points is that you're getting Nintendo eShop deals, but those are not free games that you lose if you stop your subscription. It's just like a rebate. So basically, if you wanted to, like, just pay the $4 for 1 month, get the games that you want. Like, if there's a particularly good deal on a game that you want, and then cancel your subscription.
Yeah, that's something that, I mean, even not having Xbox Live Gold, you know, they kind of try and push it to you in those terms. If you look on the store and there's a sale, it's like, well, it's, you know, 30% off if you're just, you know, not a subscriber, but you might get up to 50% off if it's gold. And like you said, if you was a gold member, you're just like a trial membership, you could, you know, vacuum up some of those extra discounts and then just, you know, not renew, hypothetically.
Well, and so Sony and Microsoft have both started offering another tier of service in the form of, for Sony, it's the PlayStation Now, and then for Microsoft, it's Game Pass, where you get access to games as part of your subscription. They're very different price structures, too, though. I think PS Now is like $30 a month, whereas Game Pass is $10. And part of the reason is how they offer that to you. Game Pass essentially lets you download games and run them just like you bought them, but only as long as you keep your Game Pass membership up. I think the games you get for gold, which is different, so every month Microsoft puts out 3 or 4 games as games with gold, I think you actually do get to keep those.
Yeah, I mean, you
they're
buy
not,
them.
They're not...
Yeah,
you're not contingent on your subscription.
The game. Yeah, you're not talking about deals with gold. You're talking about games with. Yeah, those ones are contingent on your subscription. Yeah, yep.
Oh, they are.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Even the Xbox 360 ones.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm
sure.
Why
don't they pull that off?
I'm sure they are. I mean, they're only there. I mean, they're just like the PS Plus free games. It's exactly the same model.
Okay, I thought they were different.
No, it's just the same.
Okay, but the stuff with Now and Game Pass is much more transient. It really is like, do you get access to this because it's a Netflix style subscription?
Yeah, correct. Yep.
I guess the free games that we are getting are probably the classic games that they're going to offer.
And you think that's got, again, in terms of, you're trying to think about Nintendo leveraging their strengths, you know, and trying to bring them into the online arena, you know, like I said, something about, you know, people playing together, but also online, that's one of them. But yeah, I mean, their classic library is formidable.
more so than anybody else's. So why wouldn't you want to leverage that?
So the reason you might not want to is you might feel like you've already hit the saturation point on being able to sell some of those games again.
Or they can make more money selling them a la carte.
But I know what you're going to say, Guillaume. It's like that doesn't seem to be a concern of theirs. But
no, but also like that's not a lesson that they would have gotten from selling us the NES or SNES Classic.
Yeah, like, but those are like weird collectible things too. Like that's
it's a physical object. It has additional, you know, less attractive to some people, more attractive to others.
It's a different value proposition.
But the classic games on the Switch are also a different value proposition. That it's the first time that we have these games portable outside of the, you know, well, a few of those games have been on the 3DS. But
a lot of the games that I could end up being the quote free games were on 3DS. But by making the games that they've given out that they've sold a billion units of, that may not be as enticing a proposition, your free games, they minimize the potential of losing sales because a certain population is going to go like, I'm not buying that game again. I've bought it three times already. But you still get to give that game away, and it's still the kind of game that people who are Nintendo fans would want to have, which makes the proposition of the subscription still valuable.
Of course, the examples that we have of games that they're going to give with a service are Super Mario Bros. 3, Balloon Fight, and Dr. Mario. And not only, you know, like Dr. Mario has been available online since like DSiWare. I think that the version was online, or at least.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. That's the thing. It's like in terms of the add-in online part, which is something they've talked about as kind of adding the value and just integrating it into this, like, I guess you want to make it more sense to people that this is part of paying for an online subscription service. Add in online features to these classic games. But yeah, Dr. Mario is not a great example because like we had the WiiWare one and sorts of stuff.
I'm not so sure about the selling power of Balloon Fight, but Mario Bros. 3, I mean, yeah, we can say like they've hit their saturation point selling us these games, but then you look at the best-selling games on Switch and Mario Arcade is on there.
Yeah, I mean, that's different. I mean, for me, it's
and
something...
That's probably part of the reason they released it, is it is different. It is a way to sell you Mario again, but it's a different
game. There's
no
doubt in my mind that Super Mario Bros. NES version would sell better because it's a better game.
You know what? I don't agree, actually. I think that game is...
Give it the leaderboard features or caravan features that the hamster games
game. Then it's a different game.
But that's what we're talking about in this, in terms of what they've said about adding online features to these games. So that is the proposition.
Yeah, but how do you define online features like that?
It's all very vague.
That's one of the questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but I mean, like if you're making Super Mario Bros. 3 one of your online games, like you're talking about a game where people took turns playing it, unless like we're just talking about the mini games where you could steal lives
versus,
from the other person,
the
or
versus mode thing, was
right?
There's
a very good chance that the online features for Super Mario Bros. 3 are going to include some sort of like leaderboards or like
speed
stuff
running
of that nature. Yeah.
I think I'm not necessarily in a position where I'm going to give Nintendo hamster level of credit for how they put together value proposition for their classic library. Like, I don't think they've done anything to earn that level of like, yeah, they're going to do that.
Well, I don't know. Like, otherwise, like, what does that mean? Like, they are only going to release their multiplayer games on this service? I don't know. Well, it doesn't make sense to me. I think that they are going to try to pawn off their, you know, like Zelda again and stuff like that. And like, it's yeah, people are going to be competing in single player games with online features, like online leaderboards.
I think you're a crazy person. I don't think Nintendo is going to do any amount of effort on that because the value proposition for them for selling their classic games is they don't have to. It's
But here they're trying to, like, this is all to sell their service. Like, they have to give us something more than just you'll be able to play online games online,
yeah,
I think.
That's basically because, well, table stakes at this point.
Like, that's like the bare minimum that they can give us, and they have been giving us the bare minimum for a long time. And we've accepted it because, like, it was free. But, like, even if it's cheap, even if it's only $20 a year, like, there's still a difference, like getting people to open their wallets to pay online.
Yeah, and it feels like taking something away more than give, you know, that. So, you know, you have to offset that by something that feels like it's being given to you to some extent, anyway.
Yeah, I just don't think they're going to go that far. I think that's you've just described work. And I don't know that that's going to get done in that case. You might see their already multiplayer games get stuff, or games that have like scoreboards already get things in there. But I don't think you're going to get like, here's the Zelda time attack scores. We've added this to all of our Zelda games.
What I think is that maybe we're not getting a Mario versus Donkey Kong game from NST. You know, that's
they've just been.
I guess that's what I'm gonna say. Yeah, like I think they've been. They've been roped into working on that kind of stuff.
And I think if you look at what they all say, Nintendo's reticence to charge for online over the years, and then the fact that they are gonna cross that line now and they're gonna do it more than a year into the system's life and all that kind of stuff, I think they'll be quite self-conscious about trying to kind of balance that out.
And I think they already are by making theirs a third the price of their competitors. That's them being self-conscious.
Yeah, that's part of it. That's a fair point. But still, I think that they will feel pressure to compensate in some fashion. Whether people end up feeling like it's a fair trade is another matter. But it wouldn't surprise me if they did some things that you kind of like, yeah, you know, they didn't have to do that, but they did. Because, you know, they kind of wanted to make it up to people a little bit and feel like they're getting something snatched out from under them.
So the most important reason for doing online charging for online has nothing to do with the cost of running an online service.
It's just revenue streams. I mean, some of it is just a simple case of they know there's people who are willing to pay, you know, this sort of money for some sort of subscription service. You see it on other platforms and some of the other examples that GX notes, and it becomes this, you know, kind of dependable revenue stream for them that's there, you know, that they can rely upon, and it helps their planning and diversification and all that kind of stuff. So it's just malpractice not to tap into that. Well,
it actually goes beyond that. It's that the people who make the decision to pay for the service on the other platforms also spend more money. Like not even if you take the cost of having the service out of the equation, they spend more money on the online store, on add-on features.
So once they're invested into that platform, then they you know, it's kind of in for a penny, in for a pound type of mentality.
Yes. And that is crucial because it means you get to continue to get money out of them beyond just the cost of, you know, the subscription service. You get to continue to make money off of them by selling them games. You can say, hey, you're getting this game at a discount. Well, sure, you're getting it for less than you would pay for it without the service, but you may just be getting a game you would have not bought anyway.
Yeah, and so ultimately, it's still you're buying extra revenue generated.
You're buying it digitally, which means Nintendo makes more money regardless if they give it to you 10% off, 20% off, because they ain't giving a retailer a cut. They're not making a Switch cart. They're not putting it in a box. They're not shipping it. It lets them sort of backdoor do the thing that they've been reticent to do with retailers of charge less for digital copies. They say, well, we're not charging less. This is the digital price. We're just giving our online customers a coupon, effectively.
Well, we're already a little bit there with the gold thing again.
I mean, that exchange rate is not much.
It's 5%. That's what it is. It's 5%. Yeah. It's not great, but it's not nothing. So
no.
It's better than my credit card.
Mm-hmm.
You need to get a better credit card, sir.
Well, I would have to pay for it. That's dumb.
Nah. I don't have, okay. I don't have to pay for mine, so that's fine.
Canada is a different market.
Get 100% return rate on your credit card, or you're not a baller, obviously. 110% return.
Have you got the Bat credit card from Batman
right.
and Robin? Is that the one?
Yes. I remember what movie it was that made up a credit card, like a really outrageous one, and then American Express went and made it. It was like the double secret platinum card was the thing from them, and they're just like, "You'll just make that." It's like that's the dumbest shit in the world. Why? I just don't think that they're gonna go and retool a bunch of games that they don't have to. I think they're more likely to just try to give you other stuff that doesn't take work.
I think the counter argument to that would be what they did with their Satellaview service, which had, I'm looking at it right now, they had what they called best selection games, which were, they had top selling titles that were, the games ranged from direct ports and exact replicas of the earlier games to games that had already been released, to remakes and remixes of games with improved graphics and increased functions. Then they had monthly event games, where, like, you know, they would have, you know, do this and you have, you know, national rankings and everybody competes with it, which they've kind of already talked about doing, or at least, you know, kind of described. And then they had original games that were released for the first time via Satellaview, and new entries in established series available only via Satellaview.
So Satellaview had external money involved, though. Mm-hmm. That's an important distinction.
Yeah, but, you know, often Nintendo tends to go back and, like, recycle ideas that they had, like, not 5 years ago, but 30 years ago.
And they just recycled the Mario's costume from a Satellaview commercial in Odyssey. So.
Oh, yeah, like, that's it, huh? That's their telegraph. Yeah.
It's a Freudian insight into online strategy.
Yeah, that's it.
Nintendo's just very interesting, though.
But,
and,
tell you, John, is
you can look all the way back like that.
There weren't that many Satellaview games, and I've played a bunch of them. Like, there's a decent number. But one of the things that you noted on there were event games. It wasn't like they said, we're going to put all these classic games out there, because that's not even how Satellaview worked. It wasn't like you could just get games on demand. It was
a broadcast.
Yeah, it was
broadcast.
Yeah,
it's like
stuff.
At between 3 o'clock and 5 o'clock, we will be broadcasting this weirdo mishmash of Zelda that we've put together.
Mm-hmm.
So set your SNES to record. What a strange phrase I just uttered.
Yeah. I mean, my point is, though, you can see from that sort of historically what they have considered valuable in this type of service.
Well, and so when I said earlier, like, they're going to do events, that might be the kind of thing they would do. They would push out, like, a not like we're going to go remake all of our Punch Out now. Like, they would push out for stuck games that we already have. They'd push out, like, an event that's going to run. And it's going to not just be it's Splatfest time once a month. You know, maybe the game would get reskinned. Maybe there'd be some weird content happening. It's just a different experience in all of your games that they do online. I just don't have a lot of faith in them to do anything like super hardcore. Like, we're going to change everything about how these games work. Just because we're going to rewire all of these online games that we made 30 years ago, or these non-online games we made 30 years ago to be online and have all this other stuff. They might do it on occasions just to sell you those games again. I just don't see them giving away, like, these super enriched games on a regular basis, because that takes that's a non-negligible amount of effort. And for $20 a year, I feel like they'd charge more if that was their plan. Because that would be, like, 3 Virtual Console games. And Virtual Console games don't have a bunch of upgrades.
Well, I could see it being a mix of the sorts of, you know, that they've already talked about, the kind of event type, you know, games of the month, or, you know, things that are, you know, kind of trying to get people to kind of congregate around one particular game. But then maybe also the service involves access to a library of unaltered games.
Yeah, so if they are going to alter classic games, do not expect them to alter many of them. Expect to see a lot of retreads. Like, oh, hey, it's Punch-Out week again, or Punch-Out month again. I know it was Punch-Out month last January, but this January, it's also Punch-Out month. Like, because it's a lot of work. It really is. It's not, like, Hamster does this on scale because this is what they do. This is their business model. Nintendo's running a whole company doing a lot of other stuff besides finding arcade games they can expose stuff in. It's a different ethos.
I just feel like they can pull it off if they can just alternate between giving us a simultaneous multiplayer game, just regular online net play or whatever, and then adding like leaderboards to the more kind of single player focused affairs. I don't know, but maybe I'm just drastically underestimating the amount of work that goes into net play. I don't know.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, but they also maybe they pushed everything back and have been working on a bunch of stuff for the last year and are going to have a whole bunch of stuff in the pipeline.
Thing. You do wonder. You know, I mean, you look at his kicking the can down the road, as GX says, and there's probably an element of that, but. I assume there's some material reason for the delay.
It's kind of maybe they're just applying the strategy that they've been applying for their retail releases. You know, like they made sure to have one big retail release a month for the first year of the Switch, and so like maybe that's their MO for the online service.
I mean, that's definitely been their MO for their classic games for platforms. Make sure there's never any downtime.
Well, Switch is a new beginning.
Yeah.
Everything's different now, James.
Nothing is different. They are the same company they've always been. Why are we pretending they aren't?
No way, man. No way.
I have to argue this point. The fact this has come up, I have to say it now. The voice chat app is the Nintendo-est fucking thing that's ever happened. They are the same company. They just got it right this time
the
Switch.
Microsoft Azure,
sure,
James.
But I don't know. I think the voice app is that $40 difference between services.
But the voice app only supports one game.
I know. Like, I'm not saying that Nintendo is this completely different company now. I'm just saying, like, I just don't see what else they could be offering to get us to pay $20 a year.
Like, we're taking away your online.
It seems.
Yeah, that's what they can offer.
I'm not that attached to
Splatoon
2.
We will shoot the hostage. That's what they're offering you, Guillaume.
pop quiz hotshot.
you know the grocery store scene in Cobra? Right now, Nintendo is doing the grocery store scene in Cobra. Are you Sylvester Stallone enough to deal with it? I don't think you are. So...
God.
I still haven't seen that movie. At this point, I refuse to.
How have you not seen that movie?
No, he's better off in general.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, that's what
off.
I gathered. Yeah.
Watch the half hour of it. That's worthwhile.
Yeah, it's true. It really craters after the first half hour. You know, it's wall to wall horseshit for that first, and then it just kind of it's just kind of boring. Actually,
we have to tell a story now.
And then he shoots a bunch of people on bikes. Mm-hmm.
I mean, he shoots like 38 people on bikes.
It's a lot of people on bikes.
surely we've got time for another email.
Oh, yeah, we do. We do. Sure. Greg, would you care to read another email?
Okay, so Joe Purival Lado writes, "Hello everyone, and welcome to the most exciting day in the world of video gaming. That's right, folks. Free Agency opens in just a few hours. There's a lot of crazy rumours flying around about what franchises could be up for grabs, and to help you sort through the fluff, we've assembled the Mount Rushmore of gaming journalism, the RFN crew. Gentlemen and James, what blockbuster trades do you think Nintendo should make, either with other console makers or major third-party developers? What free agents, games whose last installment sold well but not spectacular, do you think they should target and or be willing to let go of themselves, and to whom? Finally, what waiver wire pickups, games that haven't even shown up since the Wii or earlier, or games whose last installment bombed, do you feel they should target? And what games do you think other developers, including indies, should look to score as a deal from Nintendo?"
All right, I'm going to start with one that Nintendo should be willing to trade, and I know who they should trade it to. It should be Kid Icarus. And they should trade it to the Arthritis Foundation.
That makes no sense.
No, it makes perfect fucking sense if you play Kid Icarus Uprising.
You're assuming they're opening up an interactive entertainment division.
Yeah, no, I actually think they just need to bury it in a vault somewhere as part of their charitable enterprise. I don't think there's a good Nintendo franchise to trade away unless you wanted to go stuff they just bought, like the ghost camera game.
But Fatal Frame.
Yeah. Like, because they're sure shit not doing anything with it.
Well, they've done stuff with it. They just haven't localized it a lot.
The same people who made the games before are still making them.
Well, that's true. Yeah. Although, like, didn't Grasshopper help make Fatal Frame 4?
Probably. That sounds like something Grasshopper would do.
I think
sure.
They did. But, yeah. I mean, the big one is, it's get it out of the way in terms of the waiver wire category that Joe mentioned there is F-Zero. You know, if you're just going to bury the guy on the bench, you may as well just cut him and let somebody else actually do something with him.
Yep. Yeah, but what if you like knowing that he can't do anything? What if
One of those. Yeah. Keyshawn Johnson in the guy.
Don't want him to go in the division, you know what I mean?
What if you're just Bill Belichick and you're just like, well, no, I'm not going to cut him. I'm not going to trade him. He's just going to spend the rest of his career here doing nothing. I think there's value in that. I think there's value in keeping someone and just burying them somewhere.
For whatever reason, like, I am kind of craving a realistic, well, not too realistic, arcade-ish racing game for the Switch and with cars and not, you know, like, the ships from F-Zero. So why not go even further into Nintendo history and just revive the F1 race franchise? And I think that would play well with, like, especially the European crowd. Like, the European market would just love this.
We do like racing. I don't know. that's true. Yeah. And apparently, the lust for Crash has inspired a Spyro collection. So
fucking hell, this is the darkest timeline.
I think Guillaume may have a point.
Remember, this was that's the game that was used to sell the four-way, like the four-player device. Yeah, I don't remember what they called it. Probably not four way, James. But the connector to play like four player games on the Game Boy. So it seems like a good franchise to kind of help motivate people to pay for your online service. And I'm serious about this. I would probably
have to call it something else though, because they're not going to pay that F1 license.
Yeah, probably not.
We
have to pay Lewis Hamilton money so he can appear in your Nintendo game.
I mean, for me, for a third party, I just think of EA and all of the studios they've killed, one of which was Visceral. And I would love to see them. I'd love to see Nintendo resurrect Dead Space on Switch. That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, maybe if they're not going to do anything much with Fatal Frame, at least globally, they could make, and they always seem to, they want to have some sort of horror thing that they can, you know, whether it was getting the Resident Evil games or GameCube order, then maybe that should be there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, to be fair, it's not that difficult to think about a bunch of series that have been, you know, because of what's happened with game, you know, with major publishers in recent times, you know, the kind of narrowing of their output, you know, right, of like, well, if it's gonna have a big budget, if we're gonna give it, you know, the big push in terms of marketing and all that, it's gotta tick all these boxes, and just that's, you know, made the output more and more kind of, as I said, narrow, and it's eliminated kind of, you know, what you would think of as, you know, maybe B tier games in the past, or even games that, you know, previously you would have thought to be top tier productions, you know, just that don't seem to be viable economic anymore. But maybe, you know, Nintendo as a platform holder and somebody that you know, does not have a philosophy of development of just like, yeah, well, we've got to throw like ridiculous amounts of money at it to make it worth selling, could, you know, do something. I mean, Konami, for instance, I mean, goodness sake, how many properties are they letting just rot, you know?
Yeah. Like,
So yeah, Betamax, it's Pro Evo, you know, is pretty much all they do these days, and that's not really a property per se, apart from the licenses of the constituent leagues involved, you know. But yeah, I mean, even Metal Gear, you've got to wonder after you know, Survive hasn't fared that well commercially and all that, which is, you know, one of the holdouts. But, you know, go down the list, Silent Hill, Castlevania, I mean, there's loads that, you know, I feel like Nintendo could do something good with.
Well, and everything they bought from Hudson.
Mm-hmm. There's kind of somewhat successful kind of, oh, it's going multi-platform now, but the somewhat successful kind of adventure on Switch with Bomberman kind of gives you a glimpse into, you know, what Nintendo could do for a lot of these dormant properties that Konami have got. That's like a whole stable of them. I know, you know, some people, until, you know, we had the announcement, could have said the same about Mega Man. You know, because obviously we went a long time with Capcom doing anything with that.
Go ahead.
The example of, like, we mentioned already Fatal Frame and Dead Space, but what's weird about this generation is that, yeah, like we've mentioned that the big publishers have kind of narrowed their output. They don't really, they've pretty much abandoned scary games because they don't sell well enough to be like AAA productions, it seems. But indies have picked up the slack, you know, and it's so I kind of wonder if Nintendo even needs to kind of rescue those franchises or do something with them when there's like tons of those games that are super popular that all sound like they have the same title to me, like stuff like Outlast or whatever. That those games are coming to Switch, you know, but they
That's the thing about having a vibrant indie scene is that that's what it will generally do, is move to fill those vacuums.
Right.
And so it might not be able to do it in quite the same way if you're talking about a particular kind of game that may like need or benefit from a massive budget in some particular way. But yeah, that's one of the great things about Switch, having, you know, this seemingly kind of healthy ecosystem for indies, is just that any kind of weakness that you can imagine emerging in a, you know, or sort of unfulfilled demand, chances are, you know, somebody will move to fill it.
But that's also where I feel like I like that Purevel's question is open to indies, because that's kind of, you know, where the puck is going, I guess, and that the metaphor that you know, like,
I mean, you're a big hockey fan, you know. We
all
know that.
Of course I am. Yes. We all know. Yeah,
he's doing a spinorama, I mean, like, right now.
You know, trying to go
that
to the
I'm
path.
Trying to imagine.
Trying to, you know, like revive franchises that we know and love and loved anyway. Like, probably isn't where Nintendo wants to go. Like, they probably want to go after like what kids are into, and so
acquiring,
they need to be
acquisitions rather than like farming out old properties,
right? Or just making sure that their console is one of the first places where kids can play certain games that might hit it big. But for that, like, they can't keep them exclusive. They just have to make sure that like the next Fortnite is playable on Switch as soon as possible, because that's the game right now apparently that all the kids are talking about, and you know, like that
I love that we're here, like, I hear about this Fortnite thing.
Well, yeah, I still haven't tried
it's terrible,
but I mean,
but it's like with the horror thing that you quote, Gio. It's like I hear things sort of secondhand about how, you know, it's quite the horror games kind of risen in popularity to some extent because of streaming, and that basically
right.
People watch people playing them go, oh shit, or whatever, you know. And it's like, I have no first hand experience.
John, we need to get Greg into streaming right now.
Sounds absolutely fucking ridiculous to
right,
me, but
that's,
apparently
that's, yeah,
it's like you helped fucking resurrect a whole genre of game, so I guess it's real.
Yeah,
John, we really need to get Greg into streaming.
Yeah, for sure.
But I mean,
was the oh shit that good? Was it?
It was that bad.
But I mean, like, the when I when I'm not kicking
children,
Karen, yeah. When I'm not kicking children, literally, but also more specifically, Karen's nephew, nephew's literally. Butt at Mario Kart. I, you know, like the games that he seems to latch onto are the games that he sees on YouTube or whatever. And so the one of the reasons why his dad bought him a Wii U, despite me being like, you might, that might not be such a good idea at this point.
I have no authority on this Nintendo stuff, but you might want to hold off on this one.
Right. So one of the reasons why was that Minecraft was coming to it. And also, at that point, Super Mario Maker was out and the kid had, you know, seen Super Mario Maker and like probably like had played Mario on the Wii before and, you know, like was aware of the franchise. But the big thing was like, oh, the streamers have told me that Super Mario Maker is where it's at. And so, you know, like before even opening up the game, before knowing he had a Wii U, like he was telling me about like, oh, do you know what, you know, what you can do with Super Mario Maker? And at this point, I'm pretty sure I had already told him like, yeah, I own the game. I've owned it since November.
Yeah, I'm just going to crush your dreams, kid. You really don't know anything.
But still, you know, wouldn't shut up about it. So that's what Nintendo needs to replicate. No, I'm not mocking him. I'm just saying.
You
like,
should be.
What I'm saying is that Nintendo probably doesn't want to court us as consumers. Like we're not Nintendo's future. Like, you know.
Yeah.
Yep. I'm already foot in the
John's
grave.
At a point now after his brush with death that he's worried he'll be dead at any minute. So he's not the future.
I don't think John's ever been more ready to spend than after his brush with death.
It's true. You can't take it with you, John.
I think John is one of the valued consumers now.
Well, it's
John.
It's
why
great,
aren't you spending money right now, John?
I will say every time Nintendo sends out, you know, a survey now, it's like, I'm inching closer and closer to the end of that. What's the age range of the person that plays this game? There's only like one more fucking button underneath the one I check. So,
and that's the thing. If you get to the last button, there's a sort of trapdoor under your chair that just tight swallows you. And
like the last one eventually
you're instantly killed by flames.
Yeah, eventually I'll just be checking like, don't even bother answering.
Is it just like older? Is that the last one?
The last one, I think, is like up to 65 or something like that, I think. But it's like the demographic, the typical ranges, right? So it's just like...
Well, it's just 65 plus, right? It doesn't say like 40 to 65, and then there's just like anything beyond that's like, no.
I'll have to check.
You can still record like another, you know, series of like RFN for twice as long as you have so far, right? So... we're still good. Another part of the point I'm very kind of failing to make is that I don't think that Nintendo should kind of acquire these properties. I think they should let developers, you know, put them on as many platforms as possible, because I don't think that something like, again, like Fortnite would be nearly as popular if it wasn't free and on everything.
Yeah.
Right.
Agreed.
So Nintendo just has to make sure to get, development kits in the hands of those developers as quickly as they can.
I think though that's not really the spirit of the question. I'm not sure the spirit of the question is like what's going to make Nintendo the most money. The spirit's like, hey, this is an opportunity to see these games revived in someone else's hands.
And also kind of just really trying to like matchmake with and right. fits, you know, stuff like, well, you know, like I said with F-Zero, if they're like, okay, we've hit a wall, we can't come up with anything. F-Zero GX is the end of history and will never be bettered, you know, then, you know, maybe they should let it go to someone who doesn't see it that way. And conversely, you know, maybe Nintendo could actually do stuff like I said with a Castlevania or something that evidently Konami's not willing to do. On the spooky game train again, Eternal Darkness is kind of a funny thing. You know, I don't know whether Nintendo are willing. They keep like upgrading the, you know, renewing the trademarks, but they didn't seem like they're that interested in
No, that's just a recurring meeting that happens every other year with an attorney.
It's like, oh, so again, if they're not willing to do something like that, maybe that should be another waiver wire for, you know, one of these indie, you know, horror developers to pick up and do something with it if Nintendo doesn't really see that it as worthwhile.
Yeah, I mean, you can always, but in something like that, you can always just make the, quote, spiritual successor. And in fact, that's what Dennis was trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Dennis Dyack, and Johnny's here to go, no, Dennis is fine. So
it's a bit of a tangent here, but like, what is the best spiritual successor game in that vein? Like, that's actually worked out.
None, because they can't manage their money.
I mean, it's not Mighty Number 9. That's I've not played it, but it sure as shit doesn't sound like it.
No.
I guess we hope Bloodstained could be that, but it's not out yet, so...
Probably something like A Hat in Time is pretty well reviewed. Not as much the one from the people who actually made those games in Yooka-Laylee. But it did come out. It's just regarded as being kind of meh. There's got to be one out there that I'm just missing. It's probably something in the Mega Man vein.
Yeah, but you can name about four or five off the top of your head that failed.
I'm sure there's a lot of people that's like, oh, you know, wouldn't it be nice if Nintendo could acquire, like, Banjo and Kazooie or whatever and you know, give them another go, seeing as it seems like they've kind of run their court.
They could always get Half-Life and bring Half-Life 3 out on Switch. You know what I'm saying? Duke Nukem, maybe? Come on.
Yeah, no, you know what? No, I'd be down for a Duke Nukem reboot on Switch. You know what? Let's not even a reboot. It's the same Duke. It just lives in 2018 acting exactly the same way. Mm-hmm. There you go. And everyone is reacting appropriately to that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Bloodstained is up there, but of course it's not out yet.
So we don't know. I mean, but yeah, there's things that
I
seem
promising.
I will
say there is a difference between Bloodstained and Mighty Number 9, is by this point with Mighty Number 9, I was already going, oh, no.
the red flags were already out.
Oh, the flags were already at half staff. It's like we've already gone fully into mourning at this point. But it's probably that Advance Wars Tiny Metal. Like, I know Tiny Metal's got some other fucking shit going on with it. But the game seems fine. Honestly, the idea that it's going to be worse here than it would be in the hands of another developer, like, the risk is always there that when you transition it to someone else, there's going to be problems. I think the Hudson back catalog, more than the Konami back catalog, I would like to see transitioned over to someone like Nintendo, because it's more close to their wheelhouse. I mean, there's stuff. I mean, a bunch of Hudson devs ended up working at ND Cube, which is a Nintendo-affiliated company.
I think what you're saying is you want a sequel to Mile and Secret Castle, or you want a continuation in that series.
I want to bury you under a million copies of Mile and Secret Castle. Yes. And then people will have to tap on every wall to find you.
The truth is out there, James. That's all I'm saying.
And they won't find you in time, believe me, because they'll have to check every single wall.
Shooting bubbles, James, over here. That's what I'm doing.
That's a different game, John. That's Adventure Island, please. No, Adventure. That's Rainbow Island. Oh my god. Video games are weird. There was a game where you played as a lizard and you shot rainbows and jumped on them. That's a weird concept for a game. But I mean, Hudson's back catalog isn't all rainbows and stuff, but like, there's a lot of games in there that it's a shame that they just don't get made. They'll never get made because Konami bought them for some reason just so they could take them down with them. I don't know what they did.
Yeah.
Like, if it was like a 20-year gap there where it's like they bought Hudson and then they're like, nah, this industry sucks. Let's do health clubs. Like, I could look at it and go like, all right, yeah, I know how that happened. But it's not. It was like 7. And really, it started sooner than that. So... I don't know what Hudson did, like what sin they committed, but I think it's time for them to try to find a new home. And I think with a bunch of Hudson devs working at an ND Cube, I think Nintendo could make that the home. The fine people who brought you a bunch of fucking Mario Parties and Tube Sliders can definitely bring you the new Adventure Island.
Mm-hmm. The in terms of like, so the free agents, like games whose last installment sold well but not spectacular, so that Nintendo should target. There's one developer that I wish would just come to the Switch already, and it's Double Fine. And I know that they have I don't know if it's still going on, like they have had a pretty sweet deal with Sony, kind of financing the remakes of old, you know, Tim Schafer's LucasArts games. So I understand that there are reasons why they might not come to Switch anytime soon, but when you look at the fact that Thimbleweed Park sold better on Switch than on the other two consoles, despite being available for sale for much less time, it kind of shows to me that there's some sort of, you know, there's a hunger for that kind of game, for the works of those developers. And so you would think that Double Fine's games would sell better on Switch than whatever they're selling on Xbox or even PlayStation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for that matter, I would say, you know, I would like to see, in the same vein, you know, I've talked about Blizzard coming over. I'd like to see some of their games on Switch. I'd like to see some of Telltale's games on Switch. That'd be cool.
Yeah. Mm. We already, Telltale, we already, like, there's the Minecraft game, I think, is already out, is there? And Batman.
Yeah, it's partial, isn't it, at this point?
Yeah, yeah, they don't have their, yeah, they haven't put out their whole library yet, but I understand that that developer has some problems.
Yeah, I'd like to see Watch especially right now. Stuff.
It's funny that in terms of like the stuff, you know, in terms of imagine like the old days of the console wars and kind of like the first party stuff and all that. I mean, outside of Nintendo, you know, it was a lot more important back in the day. You know, I mean, like, how important is Sony's first party stuff to PS4's success? Really, it doesn't seem that important to
apparently
me.
They're promoting Medieval, so it must be super important.
You know, and obviously, with Xbox, it's an interesting thing now that all their first-party titles are on the Game Pass service. Now, you know, you don't even have to buy them. It's kind of, you know, it's a kind of interesting way of trying to leverage their you know, exclusives or whatever. But again, it doesn't seem like it's you know, terribly important. You know, in the old days, if it was like, you know, if you could have this sort of construction that Joe set up for us, and it's like, okay, you know, you're going to poach Sonic away from Sega or something like that. You know, you'd be talking about something that would really, you know, like change the fortunes of you know, potentially of a particular console or, you know, something like that. But, you know, at least you could imagine that happening back in the day, whether it would actually have done or not. Whereas today, you know, it's only really Nintendo that you feel like has those kinds of characters that are so associated with it that, you know, if somehow, you know, hypothetically, they could be like peeled off from them, it would hurt them, you know, dramatically, because it is actually a core part of their appeal and their brand. You know, and obviously Nintendo, despite having them, you know, and you know, kind of cultivating them all these years, haven't done the most to leverage them. You know, they're only kind of really starting to peel back the layers on that now with the, you know, Universal Studios theme parks and movies and all that. You know, like they're only sort of really getting to try and explore the full value of what they've created, you know, to this point. But you know, for in terms of other people, I guess, I mean, you could say maybe Sonic would be better off with Nintendo now than he is,
or with the people, know, who made Sonic
Sonic Mania. I mean, Sonic Mania is you know, it seems to have been well received, but the you know, their regular attempt, you know, the sort of attempts to have the you know, the big modern Sonic don't seem to satisfy all that often, and certainly some of the games, you know, have been better received than others. I mean, I quite like Colors, but, you know, maybe, you know, again, that would be a case of like Nintendo could manage it better than them, so that would be an argument for them picking him up.
I like the idea that when John's talking about Blizzard, he's talking about games like Blackthorn. Like they're old SNES games where you're just a biker dude with a gun.
Oh my god. Just put the Rock and Roll Racing on the Switch and don't put the licensed music. Well, put the licensed music in there. Sorry, wrong words. Keep the MIDI music. Right.
Hell
like,
yeah.
You don't want the actual tracks. You
like,
want
don't
that,
put any
that
of
thick.
That modern Blizzard garbage in there.
None of that.
I want only
they're
the finest.
Now.
I want the death and return of Superman. God.
But Rock and Roll Racing was actually good.
Rock
what
and
I'm
Roll
saying
is a decent game, yes.
Yeah. But like keep the soundtrack sounding like it's on an SNES, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Don't want to
listen to actual Paranoid Bob Blatzap if you want.
Get Radical Psycho Machine Racing, their other Super Nintendo game.
Radical Psycho Machine.
I'm not fucking kidding. That's what it's called. Radical Psycho Machine Racing or RPM Racing. Yes.
I'll see what they did there.
That's an actual thing.
Okay. I didn't just make that up. I'm not smart enough to have made that up.
Good old Silicon and Synapse.
It's the best. It's the fucking worst and the best at the same time. All right. Well, if there's any other trades anybody wants to make, Gex.
Well,
I want to see Gex
traded
to a company that doesn't exist, so we don't have to live in a world where Gex could get revived.
You already joked about Kid Icarus, but I mean, IGN, I think, always wanted Sony of America to get their hands on Kid Icarus. Like they wanted their mature Pit, taking on Medusa, yeah. And so like,
it's not God
yeah,
of
who
War,
better?
But...
yeah, who better than the God of War developers to handle that?
I honestly, that sounds horrible. That sounds unimaginably awful. Wow, what a sad thing to bring up to end the show on, Guillaume.
I'm sorry.
What a very sad thing you've done for this episode.
Earlier, well, now picture it. Just
earlier,
you know,
talking about John maybe dying, and you actually made this worse. So here we
repeatedly
are.
Repeatedly pressing your Switch sticks to make Pit, push his thumbs into Medusa's skull.
I thought you were gonna go to a bedroom scene. So okay, I'll take that too.
Well, there's also don't worry. There's also gonna have sex minigames.
The hot spring. Obviously, it's the natural evolution.
Yeah. Yeah, that's where he gets his buns steamed.
This just confirms what we all already knew, that Matt Casamassina's dreams are everybody else's nightmare.
I love it.
Oh my god. You can send us more nightmares. I mean, we have enough, but if you feel like we need more, RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com. Kid Icarus Sex Minigame now also on the title list. Craig, what's our music for this week?
Music this week, I realized that it's coming up on the 15th anniversary of Ikaruga coming to GameCube, which it was not its first release, of course. It was in the Japanese arcades first, at the back end of 2001, and then it was out on Dreamcast, but that's when I played it. When it came out on GameCube in April of 2003. I've mentioned this before. The soundtrack I have kind of a love-hate relationship with because I like it, but I was about as ill as I've ever been in my life that when I got Ikaruga, and the soundtrack still reminds me of being in bed with an appalling fever, like just practically hallucinating. So, yeah, sort of working my way through some past traumas with this one, but like I said, I do like the soundtrack a lot, and this is the theme from the first stage of the game, so even if you did find it really hard, you might actually have heard this if you played it back in the day, and it's a very rousing, like, yes, this indeed is going to kick ass, and it did, and it still does if you play it today.
It does. He's right. All right, well, that is going to do it for us today. I apologize. I think that's the appropriate response, but bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.